You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the EU and Turkey conclude a deal on handling the migrant crisis. But will it unravel before this evening's show ends? My guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Rogers will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the crew of Air Force One blowing decades of dust off the flight charts showing the way to Cuba, the second anniversary of Russia's annexation of Crimea, and the EU's strange insistence that still further sanctions may prevent a third, and Brazil's politics not getting any less weird. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University, and James Rogers, Senior Lecturer in Journalism at City University. Welcome both back to the show. We will start with that news breaking this evening that the EU and Turkey have reached an agreement on managing the unceasing influx of migrants attempting to reach the former from the latter. From midnight on Sunday, migrants arriving in Greece will be sent back to Turkey if their asylum claims are rejected. In return, the EU will absorb up to 72,000 Syrian refugees presently in Turkey, as well as releasing financial aid to Turkey and making more of an effort to pretend that Turkey has the faintest chance of ever joining the EU. James, is this quite the shell game it looks?
I think it probably is, yes. I mean, it's very difficult to see. Perhaps this will work in the short term. Obviously, a good deal of diplomatic effort has gone into it. There's certainly a desire to make it work, but whether it really can in practice is an entirely different matter. We have to consider the time of year, too, as the weather improves. We've already seen the number of people trying to cross from the Middle East via Turkey to Europe has begun to increase, and one can only imagine that will continue to increase in the coming weeks. As for the political diplomatic side, it's been some years that Turkish membership of the European Union has been talked about, but it seems that it was talked about for quite a while and then went away, only to miraculously reappear within the last few weeks.
We will come back to that question later in this discussion, but Oscar, it strikes me at least as an attempt by EU leaders who... they're still in that terrible bind of they know they need to tackle this problem. They know the problem isn't going to go away, but they also know that they are beholden to not terrifically sympathetic electorates. Is this an exercise in misdirection in hoping that people will focus on the migrants being sent back rather than the exactly equal number of migrants they've agreed to take in?
It's a very strange smoke and mirrors exercise, as you pointed out. On the one hand, yes, the idea is that we will focus on people going back to Turkey, but not on the people coming here. And on the other hand, the deal might unravel very soon, as you pointed out. It is wrought with moral and legal flaws.
And logistical ones as well. James, is expecting... this is supposed to start happening from midnight on Sunday, which means as we appear to have given Greece a bit over 48 hours to have set up a fully functioning asylum processing system.
It does look a bit like that, doesn't it? I mean, I think with all these things... The test is going to be once the deadline comes, and one imagines that these deadlines are often set as to demonstrate political will rather than because people believe they're going to begin functioning from the time that they're supposed to. One of the difficulties, of course, has been that Greece has not been in a position to process the number of people who have arrived so far. So quite how that's supposed to change within the next 48 hours is a very big question, I think.
Greece also does not have the option of a lot of Eastern Europe does of fencing off its borders. It's the accessibility of its islands from Turkey especially makes that impossible. Oscar, we will get on to then now to the diplomatic ramifications of this. Part of the deal being dangled in front of Turkey also includes visa-free travel for Turkish citizens by June. Now, again, one has to sympathise with EU leaders to the extent that with the best will in the world, they know that the patience and sympathy of their electorates is limited. They know that they have to keep in mind the possibility that if they don't heed that, whether it's right or wrong, then far-right parties might take advantage. The prospect of visa-free travel being extended to 75 million Turkish citizens is not actually going to calm anybody down, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. And on top of that, there is the generic definition of Turkey as a safe third country, which if we look at the things that have been happening in the previous 2 weeks, looks an exaggeration at best.
Well, that is a further consideration, James. To what extent is regarding, and how to put this tactfully, regarding the Turkey of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan as a reliable partner an exercise in wishful thinking?
It's an exercise possibly in wishful thinking. It's certainly an exercise in diplomatic pragmatism. If we see the way that academics have been treated, if we see the way that prominent news media have been treated, not just in a high-profile case...
up to and including the nationalising of a newspaper and the deletion of its entire
Indeed,
archive.
And this is just merely a high-profile example of something which has been going on for a number of years.
Also, migrants are being mistreated, which means that this deal is very much on the edge of violating international law.
Mm. So I think this is an example of where the European Union is having to deal with partners as it finds them rather than it wishes as they were.
I mean, it is the great unknowable, Oscar, but as you point out, there are any number of obvious legal, moral, ethical, political difficulties with this deal. If it does unravel, then what?
That's of course the question to which our diplomats have no answer, and that's precisely the problem. But what we know for a fact is that this is no solution. It is no long-term solution. There are other solutions which have to do with actually complying with the legal obligations that Europe has vis-a-vis migrants and clearly towards refugees, rather than trying to horse trade the rights of migrants, thereby dehumanizing them.
Just a final thought on this, James, and it's just a thing that's occurred to me, is that the one thing that I don't think we've seen an EU leader say, we've seen them at various points adopting all positions from none shall pass to come one, come all. But I don't think we've yet seen a major EU leader stand up and say to their people, look, there isn't actually a solution to this. We can't stop the people from coming. Nothing we do is going to stop them from coming. We can only manage this as best we can. You're all going to have to be a bit patient.
Yeah, well, I think that's because politicians are expected to have answers, particularly in the uncertain times in which we live, and people who are, as you say, facing electorates are not supposed to say, I don't know what to do. And so I think that's why, even if we can see from the difficulties that just in a matter of a conversation of some 5 or 10 minutes we've been able to identify in this deal which has been presented tonight, then I think, we can see that politicians just aren't supposed to say that. But I think a lot of people realise that that really is the case.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, why aren't we expecting from our leaders precisely leadership? At least one of them should take the risk, bite the bullet and take the risk and tell us that there is no clear solution to this problem.
You could make the case, though, that Chancellor Merkel has tried to offer some leadership and a clear solution. And as we see from the local elections in Germany last week, it seemed by a lot to have paid the political price for that.
She has my sympathy.
Well, let's move on to something which is hopefully slightly more hopeful, which is this coming Sunday, when if all proceeds according to doubtless meticulous plans, we will have a defining image of President Barack Obama's foreign policy. When Air Force One touches down in Havana, more than half a century of pointlessly frozen relations between the United States and Cuba will finally be thawed. Obama is a few months away from being the 10th US president that the Castro regime has outlasted. So why, we need to ask, has it fallen to him to be the first one to visit? Oscar, interesting quirk reading through President Obama's schedule. He will, of course, be meeting El Presidente, Raul Castro. White House officials at absolute pains to stress that he will not be meeting with Fidel. Why is that idea still so horrifying to the United States?
Well, look at the millions who are about to elect Donald Trump as nominee. And then you begin to understand why. Of course it's silliness. One has to admire this, this sort of principled pragmatism that is beginning to be termed the Obama doctrine. Here you have, on the one hand, the pragmatist element. I am going to sit down and talk to Raul Castro. And then there is the sort of principal matter, but I am not going to talk to the brother because of the symbolic implications. Still, the result is the same, and that's what matters. I'm very happy to say that we announced this was going to happen almost 8 months ago. It is certainly a historic visit.
It is, isn't it, James, a terrific illustration of what Oscar just called the Obama doctrine, because when he first announced this, and I can remember him vividly first announcing this, because he announced it just before 6 o'clock our time, when I'd already written the script for that evening's Midori yeah. House, which I then had to rewrite very, very quickly. Thanks, Barack Obama, for that. But his speech at the time, I can remember just thinking, this is a man just saying, this thing we've been doing is stupid. Let's just stop doing it because it's dumb.
Yes, very much so. And I think, excuse me, I mean, Mr. Obama was dealt a pretty tough hand in international affairs when he first came to office. With, of course, the United States had involved in two unpopular military campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so, in foreign affairs, he's had tremendous challenges. And I think perhaps, obviously, given the stage of his presidency at which he finds himself, he has his eye on his legacy. And this is obviously this is a situation which many people outside the region will have seen as absurd, although it was quite clear, rooted in the Cold War, why it continued. The Cold War has been over for a quarter of a century. And so Mr. Obama clearly saw this as an opportunity to be remembered for something positive when his presidency has been marked by so very many large challenges. The symbolism, of course, will be important. But with all these things, we can imagine the diplomats will have been discussing for weeks behind the scene dissidents are okay to meet, which dissidents aren't okay to meet, and how he's going to manage to make an American foreign policy point without offending his hosts too much.
The minutes of those meetings would make absolutely riveting reading. But aside from the diplomatic protocols, and again, the body language will be entertaining to watch. Yeah. What kind of reaction can he expect from the people of Cuba? Will this be a huge, huge deal, Air Force One touching down at Havana?
It will be for Cubans, and you will see tremendous support, a lot of enthusiasm. Cubans on the ground, and you know, I've been in the country not long ago, are very hopeful about this new chapter. It means a lot to them. They're not thinking about, having, McDonald's in every corner. God forbid, that would ruin Havana.
But I give it 3 months.
Let me hope. But what they say is that, there is a humanitarian dimension to this. There are families on the other side. Also, the possibility of building an economic future for a country without the obstacle and or excuse of the measures taken by the U.S. government. That is very important.
Just to follow that up, though, Oscar, and I guess to ask the same question from the other perspective, is there much recognition either among Cuban people, or do you think among the Castro brothers in particular, that basically it has been the United States blockade that has kept them in power?
I'm sure that is being thought about. In fact, I've heard it from a couple of officials, and they know that this is a huge risk, but one that they're willing to take, among other things, because there is no other option. I love those moments
when you carry on doing this for another 50 years.
When you are you're acting against the odds, they cannot carry this. The economics are unviable and so on. So something had to give away.
James, again on Obama as a foreign policy president, though, as we've been discussing, he's been notable for his caution and his pragmatism, which the rest of the world has regarded as something of a relief after the adventurism of the previous president. But why is it that Cuba, it does seem to be the only arena in which he's felt able to just act decisively and actually quite quickly, though he did still leave it until fairly late in his presidency.
Well, I mean, I think you highlight the reason probably in your question, because I mean, America's it's difficult to remember now, but of course President George W. Bush came to office looking at the way that the United States had been forced to intervene in the Balkans in the 1990s and saying that they were going to reduce their commitment to international affairs, when of course quite the opposite happened in the form of very large military operations. And I think that's probably why Mr. Obama has been more cautious. We remember his red line in Syria, were chemical weapons to be used there, but of course that wasn't followed up upon because of the lack of clear military options there, and of course with the memories of those ultimately unpopular military campaigns elsewhere in the region.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Rogers. Coming up next, it's 2 years today that Russia formally annexed Crimea. Are more sanctions really likely to persuade them to go home?
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
You're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Rogers. Now, 2 years ago today, Russia formally annexed Crimea. This occurred just a few weeks after the first troops, pretending not to be Russian soldiers, had begun seizing key facilities on the Ukrainian peninsula, and 48 hours after Crimeans had voted overwhelmingly to transfer their allegiance from Kiev to Moscow, though that 95% in favour should probably be read with a fairly hefty asterisk alongside it. 2 years later, the EU is calling for more countries to impose sanctions on Russia. The question being, James, I'll ask you first, given that Russia has made it clear again today that it has precisely no intention of going anywhere, is there really any point?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I'm quite certain that EU diplomats know very well privately that there's very little prospect of this being reversed. This is something which Russia has dreamed of for a very long time, and something which in the eyes of his electorate, Mr. Putin has delivered. I mean, if we look at how he's decided to mark the second anniversary, he's gone down to look at the area where a bridge is going to be built to connect Crimea to, as they see it, the rest of Russia. Hugely symbolic, of course. Mr. Putin is saying, and a Russian news agency report I've been reading this afternoon, talking about how this is something they've dreamed of doing for most of the 20th century, going back to the last Tsar first having the idea of doing this in 1910, and then triumphantly saying, but under Mr. Putin, this is actually going to happen. So the symbolism is tremendous. Not only are we not going anywhere, we're going physically to make sure, alongside diplomatically, militarily, we're going physically to make sure that Crimea is joined to Russia.
Oscar, as James points out, it is hugely popular, certainly with Russians, arguably indeed with Crimeans. But one recent poll found, and again, that figure of 95% of Russian people outside Crimea approving of it, of the annexation, that is, despite the hardship caused by sanctions. Has Vladimir Putin discovered that nationalism will actually trump the economy?
Maybe. He's... two victories in internal politics, you know, the gamble in Syria and the annexation of Crimea seem to go precisely in that direction. Having said that, of course, this is a matter of time and scale. The sanctions have had some bite. They have caused hardship. I think you have a point. Here, the kind of leadership that he's projecting, going back to the memories of the 19th century, of pre-communist Russia, bringing back the figure of the Tsar, that is tremendously important, historical memory for Russians. And in moments of hardship, those symbolisms do tend to work.
There was another poll I was reading, James, which struck me as interesting, that 75% of Russians also believe that the invasion and annexation of Crimea has just been an excuse for sanctions that the West planned to impose anyway. Do we yeah. underestimate, and I think possibly because it just seems so weird that a country like Russia, the size of Russia, with the power of Russia, would be scared of anybody or anything. Do we actually underestimate the degree to which Russia does fear the West and does feel justifiably or not actually threatened?
We do. I mean, I lived in Russia for many years, and you certainly in the 1990s, when Russia was weak in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, people really did feel that the West was taking advantage of that weakened state to impose its will upon Russia to some extent. And that, I think, is what Mr. Putin has understood very well in his entire career at the top of Russian politics. So when you read polls like that, you realise that although people accept and recognise that there is hardship, it is not as a result of Russia's actions, it is as a result of the West's actions. That's very much the way it's perceived in Russia. And there are dissenting voices. Russia's main business newspaper, Vedomosti, said today, you know, that we will be paying a price for this eventually, but people haven't realised that. But and people are paying a price, they do realise that. But the key thing, I think, that is not always so well understood outside the country is that it is seen as the West that has initiated this and the West that is implementing this, and not necessarily something which has been done in response to Russian actions in Crimea in particular.
Well, I guess a good question, Oscar, to follow that up is the statements that have been made today by the EU calling for more countries to impose sanctions, from the US State Department reiterating the United States' theoretical commitment to the territorial integrity of Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We were just discussing in the first half of this program the unfreezing of a long overfrozen diplomatic standoff. At what point will the rest of the world just eventually just decide, look, this is what it is, whether we like it or not?
Well, let's hope that comes sooner rather than later, because as you're suggesting, these although the sanctions matter as in terms of taking a stand and as a matter of principle, clearly they're not having the effect and will not have the effect that they aim for. In fact, the Russians, Russia's diplomats have restated today that under no circumstances they will be discussing the Crimea situation.
I mean, again, drawing on your experience of having lived there, James, is this a lost cause? Would it be possible to raise the price so high that Russia would not regard Crimea as worth the hassle?
I think it's difficult to foresee in the near future. I really do. I mean, I lived in Moscow for a number of years and used, when I was a journalist there, to travel to Ukraine sometimes. And people would say to you when you said you were going there, tell them to give us Crimea back. It's an example of Mr. Putin really understanding his constituency. And he knew that this was a massive, historic, symbolic gesture which he could make and which would ensure that he went down in history as a powerful leader. And that's obviously why he's visiting there to look at the way they're going to build a bridge.
Okay, well, finally tonight, when it was announced earlier this week that the former Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, would be appointed to the cabinet of his predecessor, the beleaguered Dilma Rousseff, the very week after prosecutors had sought his arrest over a money laundering racket, there were those cynical souls who noted that such an appointment would have offered some protection from legal action and wondered how much of a coincidence it all was. It would appear that at least one Brazilian judge is not buying it and has blocked Lula's mooted promotion to chief of staff. Oscar, was the idea of Lula this week of all weeks joining the cabinet the obvious stitch up it looked?
Well, now he has joined the cabinet. The legal measure
Indeed.
Has been thrown out. This is the one and possibly last chess move for Dilma. It is an extremely risky move because it makes Lula, in fact, a sort of super minister in charge of rebuilding the connection between the Workers' Party and its social basis, but also negotiating in Congress some kind of deal, which has been asked for by members of the Workers' Party itself. The problem is that the degree of polarization now is such that that kind of agreement does not look likely in the foreseeable future, and that will just deteriorate the political chaotic situation of Brazil, which will not allow Brazil to take care of what it needs to be taking care of, which is its economics.
Just to follow that up, though, because it is very difficult to keep track of every bizarre development currently occurring in Brazilian politics, but the most bizarre of this week's was, of course, the leaking of a tape by Judge Sergio Moro, who's leading the Petrobras investigation. And this was the tape of Dilma telling Lula that she would send him the decree appointing him just to use in case it's necessary. There's no other way of hearing that, is there?
Dilma has said that the other way of hearing that is in case Lula could not come all the way to Brasilia to take possession. But even if the reading of that is the other one, it has to be said that most of lawyering profession has condemned these measures taken by Moro. And in fact, this is now going to move up to the Federal Supreme Court. And there are members of the Federal Supreme Court who are also pointing out that the danger of the current politicization of the Lava Jato operation. So now we are in a situation in which one might just as well stop watching House of Cards, because this is becoming, in comparison, that is, Kevin Spacey is just, a child taking a walk in the park.
James, 3 million people marched against Dilma on Sunday, according to the best guesses of Brazilian media. There were more protests following the release of this tape of Dilma and Lula discussing whatever it was they wanted this decree for. How bizarre and weird could this get? Because, of course, the other thing, the obvious lid on the pressure cooker, I guess, and this is going nowhere. It's 140 days until the Olympics starts. How much more pressure does that put on everybody involved?
Well, I think it puts a lot of pressure on everybody involved because, Brazil is going to be in the international spotlight as countries hosting the Olympics always are. I mean, it's a journalistic standard before major sporting events to do stories about how the stadia aren't ready with only so many days to go. But they haven't even needed to fall back on that. I mean, set aside the political theatre which is underway. And of course, these are times when the law professors, the senior Supreme Court judges, whenever we find these political crises, find themselves thrown into the spotlight as never before. They may have spent many years studying and practicing law. They find themselves under this intense media scrutiny. The Olympics are coming up. And of course, Brazil has got the additional challenge in that particular arena, the Olympics arena, that is, of the Zika virus as well to contend with, which may be putting a lot of visitors off from coming to the country. So the fact that Brazil is once again going to be under the international spotlight this coming summer, it does make things increases the pressure immeasurably, I would have thought.
Oscar, the demonstrations have been of extraordinary scale. There will doubtless be more where they came from. How ugly could this get?
Well, the question is, of course, the provenance of these protests. They are invariably middle upper class and white people. In fact, there is a wonderful photograph making the rounds in social media of two white middle class protesters with the black nanny in tow carrying the child on a pram. That says it all, because actually this is reality following fiction.
Is that a real photograph?
It's a real photograph which corresponds to a meme that which had been circulated before. So what this means is that there is a limit to what these protests can do. Also, we're now going to see the counter protests by those who are sympathetic to the Workers' Party. But mostly their message is save democracy from what they see as a coup in progress.
Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there. Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Rogers, thank you for joining us on Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mari Giusti. Our studio manager was Weidong Lin. There's more music next. At 1900, Marcus is in with The Menu, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200 tonight. London time. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.